bit of reverse recovery in the diode by replacing the diode with a Schottky. We still found some switching losses present in our boost converter. We dug in, looked at this MOSFET, found that it had, even though it got rid of this stored minority charge characteristic of a diode, we still do have some parasitic stored charge in the form of these capacitances. And this is no longer built up minority carriers like it was in the diode. Instead, this is really just parallel plate capacitors within this device. If we look at some of the results of these capacitances on MOSFET operation, again, we kind of skipped over some things. There are some additional more complex loss mechanisms having to do with my driving signals no longer being ideal when I have some capacitance gate to source. But the one that we looked at and focused on is how this drain to source capacitance affects converter operation. Found that including both the diode and MOSFET output capacitances, we have some additional switching losses. The switching losses occur when the MOSFET turns on. When it turns off, these two capacitances are charged or discharged in a lossless manner, just capacitances charged by a constant current source in this inductor. When the MOSFET turns on, we short out its own capacitor and lose all of its energy. And then we lose an equivalent amount of energy to that which is stored in CJ from charging it through a voltage source plus resistor. We did a little bit of analysis, we'll cut that slide out, showing that even if the MOSFET has no on resistance, we still lose this amount of energy in charging that cap. So that at the end of class, we got into some more general comments about converter design, talking about what is a typical range of switching frequencies. For most of the converters that we'll look at, typical range would be somewhere around this 100 kilohertz point, a little higher, a little lower. And what are the reasons why we might want to go higher switching frequency or might want to keep it low? So right at the end, we talked about converter optimization briefly, things like trade-offs between efficiency and power density, which is a measure of the size of the converter for a given power. And okay, as we go up in switching frequency, we should be able to make the thing smaller by needing smaller inductors and smaller capacitors to meet given ripple constraints. At some point that breaks down though. We go so high in switching frequency that these switching losses start to kill our efficiency. Then we need to start adding fans to it to keep it from overheating. Then it gets bigger. And that's this point here. At some very high switching frequency, we start to lose efficiency and lose power density. These type of curves, I could put one together for one converter, but if I change to a different topology or different devices, I might move to a different curve, has a similar shape, but maybe higher efficiency and lower power density, maybe this blue one or red one. Shift around, I can do some optimization of the selection of my topology and devices. One other comment I want to make in terms of converter design is on device selection. So from what we've looked at so far, if I'm selecting a MOSFET, more often than not, I'm going on DigiKey and I'm kind of selecting a part based on its data sheet and its performance characteristics. Why the trade-offs are what they are, I'm going to discuss, I'm going to motivate that, assuming we had the ability to create any MOSFET we wanted. We're actually going in this silicon cross-section and making our own MOSFET. And if I were to do that, I would have some die and I would customize my MOSFET. This is my chunk of silicon. And as we've talked about, I would build up the height of this, which would be the height of that drift region in our cross section. And that would give me the voltage blocking capability that I need. My height kind of dictates what the breakdown voltage of the device is. I need it to block 600 volts. I'm going to need to make it tall enough to do that. And then my area I can choose, if I make this thing a bigger area, what I'm effectively doing is putting more unit cells of MOSFET in parallel, and I'm going to cause the on resistance to go down. So my on resistance is going to be proportional to 1 over the area. But by making this thing bigger, all of my stored charges are going to go up. So things like CDS, QG, etc. are all going to be proportional to the area. Okay, and simple proof of this, say I have some die, it's X by Y, and it has a total area A. And I'm at, this is a 600 volt MOSFET, and I make it a certain size. This is now my MOSFET, and it has some R on, CDS, QG, all these other parameters that we've talked about. And then I go and make a new MOSFET, and I make it X by 2Y. This is just one transistor, but I can kind of envision it as two of this transistor hooked up entirely in parallel. So that's going to look like just two MOSFETs in parallel. And now it's going to have a resistance of two R-ons in parallel, which will give me R-on over 2. Then my drain to source capacitances are going to be in parallel. Capacitances in parallel add. That would be 2 CDS. However much charge went into my gate, I now have to supply it to 2 gates. So I'm going to have twice the charge. So on. So as I build up a bigger MOSFET, I'm going to gain advantage in conduction losses. My resistance is going to go down, but I'm going to take a hit in all of my switching losses because all of my stored charge is going to go up. So generally speaking, if I look at how big of a MOSFET do I want to select, area versus power loss, I go up in area, conduction loss is going to go down proportionally. My conduction losses are proportional to the square of current times this resistance. What I'm going to end up with is a 1 over X type relationship for my conduction losses. For my switching losses, they look like 1/2 CV squared times FS. I change the area, they're going to be directly proportional to these storage charges. So my switching losses are going to do this. And then I'll have some sum of these two that looks something like this. This is P total. A very small MOSFET has a high resistance and I have a lot of conduction losses. Very big MOSFET, almost no conduction losses, but a ton of switching losses. Somewhere in the middle, there's an optimum where I can minimize losses selecting the device area, my optimal area. Okay. So, like I said, unless you're doing an integrated circuit design or you're working for a company with a ton of money, you probably don't get to create your own device. You select from commercial discrete devices that are out there that you can buy. But these same trade-offs are going to apply. Once you start looking at different manufacturers, everything doesn't scale perfectly because they do minor things differently in terms of how heavily they dope and what shape they make these wells. But generally speaking, there's this trade-off where you don't want the lowest on-resistance device you can find always. You know, you think R-on's bad, I should minimize it. doing so is going to make your switching losses way too high. Right? So you want to find the best device for you. Questions on that? Okay, more side comment here. So things like R-on is proportional to 1 over area, which is generally true. That means that R-on times area is constant. And what I can do is, assuming some height that's required for a given voltage blocking capability, I can assess different materials based on what's called the specific on resistance, which is this. RSP is R on times area. So it's just on resistance normalized by size of the thing, kind of a figure of merit. And then build up to a certain height to get some voltage blocking capability. And I can actually, if I get into the semiconductor physics of it, derive a relationship between these two that's dependent only on the material characteristics. I can say for silicon, the maximum achievable specific resistance or minimum for a given breakdown voltage is this curve here. If I want 100 volt blocking capability, a 1 square centimeter device is going to give me 1 milliohm of resistance. I need 0.5 milliohm, I need 2 square centimeters. So that's my performance limit. And I've mentioned this briefly before, silicon is kind of our standard, but today we've moved into more exotic materials, particularly these wide bandgap materials. Things like silicon carbide and gallium nitride are now commercially available. And these materials have inherently better curves, where I would need to have 10 milliohms for a square centimeter device at 400 volts from silicon. With GaN, that same area, I could have almost 100 times, a little more than 100 times lower resistance. Or I could get the same resistance with 100 times smaller die and have 100 times smaller stored charge. Better switching performance. So this allows me to shift these curves. Here was my the screen curve here was the best I could do for any device in silicon. If I go to something like gallium nitride, I might have a curve that looks like this. Blue was a bad choice. Allowing me to use less material and have a physically smaller device and to achieve smaller overall power loss. These wide bandgap materials are making their way into power electronics now that they're commercially available. They have some superior characteristics. Their popularity has come about since the book has been published. It doesn't talk much about this, and I'll kind of make some comments as we go along on where the conclusions from the book need to be modified. Again, this time I put a link. This potential website actually shows how to derive these curves from the semiconductor physics if you're interested. And this has to do with fellowships funding graduate study for students who want to do wide band gap based power electronics. We'll look at how these superior characteristics can be used to improve the performance of power converters. So silicon's the standard. GaAs has been used in RF type applications. Silicon carbide and GaN are now becoming more common. Aluminum nitride, there's a couple companies working on aluminum nitride to varying degrees. And then someday the very best material is diamond. Has fantastic characteristics, would make for near ideal MOSFETs. Turns out it's somewhat expensive and kind of hard to work with. So we're not really close on that yet. People are able to create diamond wafers, but the getting a diode that even functions is still research with that material. Okay, so conclusions on MOSFET. MOSFET is a majority carrier device as opposed to the minority carrier diode, which means that a good thing is we have no stored minority charge. So we don't have things like this reverse recovery, things like large switching loss mechanisms associated with removing all of that stored minority charge. A la reverse recovery. So we won't have that. A bad thing is I get no conductivity modulation. And these two are linked inherently. So because I don't get all of this additional minority charge when I'm conducting, my on resistance is dictated by just how heavily I dope this device and the geometry of it. And that's why I get these fundamental characteristics that I can derive here. I can make it bigger to get lower on resistance. That makes the die bigger. I can make it taller to block more voltage, but that gives me more resistance. So that kind of limits the range of voltages where we can use MOSFETs. Because they have lower stored minority charge, they can be used at higher switching frequencies. Book says 10 to hundreds of kilohertz. I would say tens to tens of megahertz today. For MOSFETs, go a little higher with better devices. But the on resistance, this will still be true. On resistance is going to increase with blocking voltage. Because to get that higher voltage, I have to build a taller device. They are easy to drive because of the isolated gate. They are the device of choice for blocking voltages less than, I would say, 1200 volts today. People might argue with me and say that should be more like 900. But really, MOSFETs are moving up and dominating kind of anything low voltage. And based on that, this is just not going to be true. So we'll get rid of that. And then we made this comment maybe a lecture or two ago. Recall that you're selecting based on really calculating losses. The current rating of a device is going to have very little to do with its merits in a power converter. It might be able to do 100 amps, but if you try to put 100 amps through it, the losses will be through the roof. Okay? So you want to size, you know, for a 10 amp application, you might be using a 1000 amp device. It could theoretically do 1000 amps. But to get the on resistance I want, I need that bigger device that could do higher current to get my losses down. Okay. Questions on MOSFETs? Not. We're going to do a quick run through IGBTs. But most of the characteristics here are going to be extensions of the things we've discussed at length already. So this is a cross-section of a power IGBT. It looks almost identical to a power MOSFET, except for this region here. This is the only difference from MOSFET. In a MOSFET, what I had is an N-type region down here at the bottom. Change it over to a P for IGBT. That's in the end going to be a significant change because by putting P-type material down here, I now allow again this minority carrier injection, which is going to give me things that we've discussed at length. So conductivity modulation is going to be great. I can go to higher voltage now and not be limited by the big resistance of this region because I inject more minority carriers to bring its conductivity up when it's on. Problem is going to be that now I have a bunch of minority carriers in there, and when I want to turn this thing off, I got to get them out, which is going to lead to a behavior that's similar to reverse recovery, but is not actually reverse recovery. We look in here, so it says this whole section just looks exactly like a MOSFET, so it is actually a complete MOSFET through here. And then this PNP looks like a BJT. If I draw an equivalent circuit of this, the MOSFET and a PNP BJT, where when I short this MOSFET, turn the MOSFET on, I create a path for base current to come through, which then turns the device on and allows collector emitter current. So conduction characteristics are really that of a BJT, but having this MOSFET here allows me to drive it more simply. I don't need to be supplying current to and from the base. I still have an isolated gate that my gate driver sees, which makes it easier to design a circuit to turn this thing on and off. So this issue of the stored minority charge in an IGBT, we don't really have some analytical expression to look at the losses associated with this. The analog of reverse recovery is current tailing in an IGBT. And typically, if we are solving out the losses due to this current tailing effect, we'll just look at the waveforms and integrate the product of voltage and current on the IGBT to get those losses. So this is showing is at this time, my IGBT turns off. Ideally, my IGBT voltage, VCE, and current, ICE, would just switch like square waves. When I turn it off, the voltage would rise to whatever it needs to block. The current would drop to zero. Instead, in a real IGBT, you see is the voltage rises relatively quickly, but you have this current tailing effect where because of all this stored minority charge, it keeps some current going through it, even as it begins blocking voltage until all those minority charges are removed. So if I multiply these two together, voltage and current, I get a curve that looks like this. The area of that, call W off in the book, is W for energy. Maybe E off would be more consistent with how I've been writing things, the total area. And this will result in a switching loss, which is E off times FS. This happens every time the device turns off, once per period. Right. And these are very zoomed in waveforms right at the switching transition. If I zoomed out to see a complete switching period, I'd still see something that just looks like square waves. Okay. So the same fundamental mechanism as reverse recovery, realized a little bit differently in an active device versus a diode. So IGBTs, conclusions on them, I would say they are still competitive in applications 1700 volts and above at high power levels in the kilowatts to megawatts type of range. Even though they are minority carrier devices, because of this integrated MOSFET, they have a positive temperature coefficient, which means they can be paralleled without these problems that we saw on the diode where one of them will hog all the current. The temperature coefficient actually changes. So if it's at room temperature, you'll have that kind of effect. One of them will take all the current, but as it starts to heat up, then the temperature coefficient changes and they'll start to share again. So they'll typically be a bit uneven, but they don't have this runaway, the 90%, 10%. The loss model, just a few classes ago, but it looks like a voltage plus a resistance, more like a diode, whereas a MOSFET just had an on resistance. That's because I'm going through a PN junction. But unlike BJTs, they've got a gate rather than a base, so they are still easy to drive. Due to this current tailing effect, they are slower or have more switching losses, should be switched slower because of the larger switching energies. So it's looking down in the kind of tens of kilohertz at the upper end for how fast I'd want to switch an IGBT. Any questions on IGBTs, power MOSFETs, diodes? This will be the end of chapter 4 at this point. Okay, we're all experts. You guys know about power devices now? So what we're gonna do then is move into chapter 5. And what chapter 5 talks about is this discontinuous conduction mode, which is a different mode of operation of the converters that we've been looking at so far. And somewhat of a minor difference, but there are a few key critical things that you need to take into account when analyzing converters that operate in this mode. So to introduce it, I'm going to start with an example. And I'm just going to do a basic buck converter. I've got some numbers here. And I'm going to plot inductor current and diode current for a couple of different cases. First, I'm just going to write kind of my ideal equations for this buck converter. My ideal analysis, V is equal to dVg. What I get from volt-second balance on the inductor. If I do cap charge balance here, I find IL is equal to V over R. And the other thing I want to know is the inductor current ripple, which in this buck is going to look like 2 delta IL is equal to the during DTS, voltage on the inductor is Vg minus V, the slope will be Vg minus V over L. So that'll be my inductor current ripple. Okay, so I'm going to give some example numbers here. I want to look at a Vg is 12 volts, V is 3 volts. What else do I have? L is 100 microhenries. And FS is 20 kilohertz, which means my switching period is 50 microseconds. And the capacitor, just for plotting these currents, I don't care as long as it's big enough such that small ripple approximations apply. So C is infinity. And I'm going to plot for two cases. First is my load resistance is 1 ohm. And second is my load resistance is 10 ohms. In general, if I'm designing some converter, I need to consider what can my load do unless it's a true physical resistor. Its power may change. I'm powering a processor or some microelectronics. Depending on what they're doing, they may take more or less power. They may shut down completely. I may need to run all the way to zero power and have my converter still operate and regulate the output voltage. I typically have some maximum of power, but typically I have no minimum. I can't rely on there being any load there. So here, I'm looking at, you know, maybe 1 ohm is full load, that's taking 9 watts of power. 10 ohms would be some partial load. I'm powering the stereo system in a car at 3 volts. This is when I'm blasting my jams. This is when I'm changing stations. So plugging in at 1 ohm, my duty cycle is going to be V over VG, which is 3 over 12 or 1 quarter. IL is V over R, 3 volts over 1 ohm, 3 amps. And my delta IL, I pre-computed at 0.6 amps. I'm going to plot these things, inductor current and diode current, try to get this more or less right here. So My average inductor current is 3 amps. DTS is 1/4 of the entire period. And my ripple around that is 0.6 amps. Means I'm going to look something like this. For my inductor current. And at TF, it'll go back up. My diode current, missed a little bit here, huh? My diode current in time is just the inductor current during D prime TS. Zero otherwise when the MOSFET's on, neglecting any kind of loss mechanisms here. So I jump up to 3.6 amps and drop down to 2.4 amps. Okay, when R goes to 10 ohms, duty cycle shouldn't change if it's ideal, if I don't have loss mechanism. My IL is now gonna be 3 volts over 10 ohms, which is 0.3 amps. And my delta IL, well, in this expression, I don't have any dependence on load resistance, so it's going to be the same thing, 0.6 amps. Now, as I sketch this case, IL is somewhere down here, 0.3 amps. And I'm going to go 0.6 amps around that. It'll look like this. And this. And my diode current, I'm gonna pop up here to 0.9 and drop down. Anything of interest? Everybody happy with that? Yeah. So negative current in the diode. Now, we just went over reverse recovery and saw that diodes can have very quick spikes of negative current to remove all of that charge. They cannot flow low frequency, continuous negative current. Diode's whole job is to not do this, right? So this is diode current goes negative. This is not possible. All this cannot happen. So what's going to happen? Well, as this current drops, once it hits zero, that diode is going to passively shut off. It's actually going to do so in a pretty nice manner where I don't have significant reverse recovery. Might have a little bit of residual minority charge that needs to come out, but I'm not going to have this huge current spike because instead of shutting it off by turning the MOSFET on and creating this shorting path here where they're both on, I'm going to let the diode current go all the way to zero and then passively shut off, sit at zero for a while before I turn the MOSFET back on. At this point, diode should shut off and hold at zero. Problem is then all of my assumptions about how this operates are wrong, right? If the diode shuts off at zero, then this is not my initial starting point for the inductor current, and my whole steady state solution has fallen apart. Okay. So this is the origin of this discontinuous conduction mode, is when I get low enough power such that my inductor current causes the diode current to try to go negative, I'm going to get a fundamental change in operation of this thing. Instead of having a DTS and a D prime TS, I'm going to have a DTS, an interval where the diode is on, and now a third interval where nothing's on. MOSFET's off, diode's off, everything's just sitting at zero current. And I need to resolve my converter to figure out how that's going to operate, because my steady state solution using my traditional assumptions doesn't work. Okay, I'll define these terms on the next slide. One comment I do want to make here is, what would have happened if this was a MOSFET instead of a diode? As he looked at in this last homework, we talked about, can always replace the diode with a MOSFET. MOSFET is just a single quadrant plus another quadrant, but it'll work. In this case, any problem with this red waveform? No. That's maybe a finer point, in that this current would be going the opposite of the direction, right? So you saw that here, your current was always positive in the homework. Now the current would be negative, which would be going the opposite direction. So it would not forward bias that same diode. If your dead time was too big, you still could get reverse recovery loss at being that top MOSFET Q1. So could be that that's there. But fundamentally, this is okay with the MOSFET. Okay? A diode can only flow current in one direction. A MOSFET, as long as it's on, can flow current in either direction. So if I made that into a MOSFET, I could do this. My red would be consistent. That would work. I could run the converter like that. It's only when it's a diode that I have a problem. The diode has these uncontrolled switching actions. I don't tell it when to turn on, when to turn off. It turns off when the current hits zero. It turns on when the voltage forward biases it. Okay. So some names for these things. Continuous conduction mode. Or CCM. Is what we've been looking at so far. We have no uncontrolled switching actions. What I mean by that is we control a D interval. And we have D prime, which is just the remainder of the interval, but I have no switching that's not at a time when I tell a transistor to turn on or off. This new thing that we just motivated is called discontinuous conduction mode. For DCM, which means that some elements ripple, causes an uncontrolled switching action. The rise is only when I have non-four quadrant switches. As I said, I can replace the diode with a MOSFET, get rid of this discontinuous conduction mode. There are other discontinuous conduction modes that occur, for example, because of accidentally forward biasing a body diode on a MOSFET. If I have a four quadrant switch, I can get rid of it. If I have all four quadrant switches, I can always choose what's conducting, what's blocking. So it's only because of limited quadrant switches that I get this. So the most common one is the one we just looked at, whether for the buck boost or buck boost. The most common case is when the ripple on an inductor goes greater than its average value. And this causes the instantaneous inductor current to reach zero and try to go negative. And if that's flowing through a diode, we're going to see a switching action there. As it tries to cross through zero and go negative, the diode's going to shut off, and we're going to have a change of the switch state. The diode was supposed to be on the whole time, but it's going to shut off. More that I'll mention here, called critical or boundary conduction mode. This is CRM or BCM. And this is just operating at the boundary. For example, in the case we looked at, if I had ripple exactly equal to the average value of the inductor current, what that would do is basically shift this purple triangle wave all the way down so it just hits zero. So I have no true full shut off of the diode. I won't have a third interval where the diode's off. I'll be right at the boundary between the two. It's sometimes used to improve efficiency of the converter a little bit, because I can reduce, if not eliminate, these reverse recovery losses by letting the diode current go all the way to zero when I turn on the MOSFET. Instead of it having a lot of current and a lot of stored minority charge, turning on the MOSFET, getting this reverse recovery, I let it go to zero. At zero current, it should have minimal, if any, minority stored charge, and then switch so I get rid of this reverse recovery effect. Okay. So it can be very high efficiency. Okay. How do we know if we are operating in DCM? So the way to figure out when a converter will go into DCM is to first ignore it. Assume converter is in CCM. Which would mean all of our analysis up to this point applies as normal in this continuous conduction mode. And then check that assumption. Okay. So solve ripple currents and average values in your passive and see if any of them change polarity at the operating point you're looking at. Okay, so in my buck example, IL V over R, delta IL is VG minus V over 2L times DTS. So what we just showed in these plots, as long as delta IL is smaller than average value IL, current will never go negative. Okay. So we're going to be in continuous conduction mode if delta IL is less than IL, let's say VG minus V over 2L times DTS is less than V over R. I'm going to attempt to simplify this expression a little bit. I'll plug in for V. V is equal to dVG. So this would be VG times 1 minus D is D prime over 2L times DTS less than V is dVG over R. I can cancel a D and a VG from both sides. And then I'm going to rearrange in a certain manner here. Let's say D prime is less than 2L over RTS. Book expresses this in two ways to figure out where this DCM boundary is. Talks about K-crit and R-crit. This is my K-crit expression, where this thing is defined as K. This is some term which describes my circuit operation, the inductance and switching period I chose, and then R, what load it's operating at. And then this is some expression which has to do with how I'm controlling this thing. What did I do with the duty cycle? So they call this K-crit, which is a function of D. K is this, always, for these converters until we get into isolated converters later. K is always 2L over RTS. K-crit of D depends on the topology. For the buck, it's D prime. For the boost, it's something else. But I can always, for any of these topologies, write some expression that looks like some function of D is less than 2L over RTS. Okay. This expression here is just for the buck. The other way the book does it, or as I said, solve for the load resistance and then develop an expression which says, what's the condition on my load resistance that'll keep me in CCM? If I resolve this thing for the load resistance, it's going to be R is less than 2L over D prime TS. And this thing is now R crit of D for a buck. So for any converter, I can again derive some expression like this. R is less than something, as this inductance and TS involved, and then some function of the duty cycle. But this duty cycle part will vary depending on what converter it is. In both cases, these things are specific to the topology. Okay, quickly, and we'll do it in more detail in the next lecture. When you want to start solving these converters, it's going to go at a fundamental level the same as what we've done before. You can apply volt-second balance and cap-charge balance. And the way we got these expressions is we just said the converter needs to be in steady state. The inductor current starts and ends at the same value. Average voltage on it has to be zero. Same thing with capacitors. But small ripple is not going to always apply now. Generally, still applies on your output capacitor. But in the case we looked at, it's a very bad approximation of the inductor current. So we cannot apply it for the inductor current. Instead, generally going to come up here in the cap charge balance equation. I'm going to have to actually take this integral with the full waveform of the inductor current. It's going to look like this triangle wave, and I'm going to have to integrate that. But I can still split this up into three intervals, solve out the waveform, and then calculate that integral in order to solve. Okay. And we will pick up and do that on Wednesday. Thanks, guys.